part of himself which belongs to the great world around and above. This type of picture, therefore, is a meditation device or symbol. The Indian's final contact with life is the voices. Now, these we would term psychic impressions. We would assume, perhaps, that the olds and the trues, the ancestral spirits, might come and speak to him. He believed that they did. But there is a certain difference between the psychism of the American Indian and the psychic phenomena of our modern civilization. The difference is in the situation and in the values involved. The American Indian had no preconceptions of life. He had nothing within himself to fight the realities which he desired to experience. He had not been indoctrinated with all kinds of beliefs. He had not developed intense neuroses of one kind or another. He had not so complicated his own inner life that when he was perfectly quiet, the thing that came through was a babble of voices. He was completely simple in himself. He expected to live and die in the position he occupied. He had no thought of wealth, no desire for authority. He had no concept of the complication of his life or of his civilization. He lived out his years as a part of a small tribal unit dedicated to cooperation. Now, it would naturally follow that such a person, becoming very quiet, would be able to open a door inward, a door that would not open into a pandemonium of doubts, fears, and anxieties, but into a very simple type of thing which would almost leap into the inner world of a small child. The Indian was, intellectually speaking, a small child, but had the tremendous integrity of childhood, which had not been spoiled, which had not been gradually tutored out of existence by the sophistication of a complicated civilization or lack of it. Therefore, the Indian psychism was very seldom dangerous. It very seldom led the wrong way. It very seldom impelled him to deeds that were not worthy. It did not give him any fanaticism. He did not become intolerant religiously. He did not become so immersed in some kind of a belief that he was unable to fulfill his common duties in tribal life. Nor was he inclined to try to go on every day trying to reform tribal life. He didn't want the tribal life to change. That would change which was according to the power of heaven. The tribal destiny was in the keeping of the medicine priest. And the medicine priest, in turn, went forth into the wilderness to pray for guidance. There was no sense of the tremendous competition of intellects among these people that we find in our modern world today. And the very simplicity of their lives contributed very greatly to the integrity of their psychic inner impressions. They nearly always came to the fact, the reality of a matter was almost intuitively and instinctively recognized. There was no need to cut through all kinds of false beliefs. There was no need for elaborate intellection on these subjects. It was to be still and very quiet and ask that which never fails, the tremendous integrity of existence itself. Now, the Indian also had certain attitudes concerning death. Of course, the American Indian never had the kind of fear that comes to those who have been indoctrinated on the subject. To the average Indian, life and death were aspects of one thing. The Indian, when the time came to go, went as he had lived, quietly and at peace with himself and the world. He did not have a descendants to fight over his estate. There wasn't any. He had no wayward children to leave out of his will because waywardness was unknown in tribal life. Therefore, in a very simple way, he went forth as he lived. One thing, however, that every Indian, of some of the tribes at least, had was his death song. He had a song that was given to him, usually by the spirits, by the Manadus, by the great ones. And when the time came for him to go forth, he went forth in glory. Cases where Indians in battle with white soldiers and so forth stood up with a bullet in their hearts and sang their death song before they fell dead. The death song was the triumph of life over everything else. The triumph of truth over error. The statement of perfect confidence in going forth into the great world of reality. This was a very simple, but it's a tremendously powerful instrument in connection with Indian thinking. It was the fact that the Indian lived without fear and died without fear. Because he knew perfectly well in his own heart of hearts that he was part of something that was eternally good, that everything was right, and therefore that there was no cause for fear. Fear came from false beliefs. While you stayed with the truth, you would find the universe was good. Also, another interesting point comes in. I brought up from the Navajo Reservation, Hastin Kla, one of the great medicine priests of the Navajo Nation. He is the one who was commemorated in Santa Fe by the Museum of American Indian Ceremonial Art. He was one of the last of the great painters and the great weaver, and today his name is cherished throughout the areas of New Mexico and Arizona as one of the greatest of his people. When he was here, a number of interesting things happened. One was that I showed him a picture we had at that time. He spoke no English. We had to use a young Navajo by the name of Haskanazwid as his interpreter. But I showed him a picture of an old Chaldean inscription. He looked at it, grunted a little bit. He was an elderly man, over 6 feet. He looked at it and he told the young Indian, he said, "My ancestors could read that." He said, "I can't, but they could." In other words, the hint there seemed to be that everything that we showed him that had to do with ancient cultures of Egypt and so was subconsciously familiar to him. Somewhere he had gotten it from the Orunda. His ancestors had told him in voice either in life or beyond the grave. But he believed definitely that he had seen, or his ancestors had seen, writing of this kind. And it's probably quite true, because there was a very definite tie somewhere to the old world. This tie is emphasized by Lord Kingsborough, who was one of the first great students of Central American civilization, and also by Lafonjon in his studies of the Maya peoples. And Lummis, who lived very long in the near southwest, in one of his books goes into a study of American Indian magic, as this is paralleling that of India. And this was a very interesting thing. Of course, as Lummis pointed out, the Indian couldn't grow a mango tree because he didn't have any mango trees to grow. But he took a kernel of corn and put it in the earth, in the kiva, and chanted and went through the rituals. And the corn stalk grew and bore fresh corn ears within an hour. Magic, the same principle, but a different instrument. One after another, these Indian doctrines seemingly can be traced back to primordial or natural magic, the power of the mind over circumstances of existence, but always with trained minds, always with individuals who had become enlightened in the mysteries of the true way. Many of the potteries of Southwest U.S. also have the famous labyrinth design associated with Crete. Here the little man is wandering through a mystic maze. The mystic maze is again another symbol for the house of initiation, through which the individual, while going along crooked paths, often ending in blind alleys, must finally find his way to the one straight road that leads home. This was the basic sign or symbol behind this entire concept. The Indian, when he was dying, if he was a good man, the old master, the priest, the medicine priest, would go with him into the other life and accompany him to the great lodge in the sky, where he would sit with his ancestors in the presence of the Manitous, the great spiritual leaders of the world. And the description of this particular procedure is almost identical with that of the ancient Irish Druids. In Ireland, the folklore is the same thing. The mystic or magician could go with the soul of the dead into the other life. There was no inferno or punishment. Each one had been himself. And because he had been himself, and because he had lived among good people, and had been a good people symbol, he went on to a better life. Some of the Indian tribes, as Schoolcraft also points out, believed in reincarnation. They believed that they did come back, not only later and possibly in the animal likeness, but come back as human beings, and that the soul itself, free of body, traveled all around the world. But of course the world to the Indian was his own reservation, but to him it was large enough. The Indian also, in his own inner life, had a situation which I think many people would probably benefit by understanding. The Indians used a limited amount of tobacco and also a limited amount of mild narcotic material for their religious purposes, never for any other reason. They used it to become a symbol of something, perhaps for the inducement of trances. Actually, those who did it in those days, and even more recently, there is no particular indication that they received adverse consequences or became habitual users or came into a dangerous psychological condition. The reason being that they had no psychological condition before they started. The ritual was simply that they were to do something to sensitize themselves. In Greece, the same thing was done. In the Roman mysteries, it was done. It was done all through the Near East and Far East, that certain herbs and so forth were called herbs of vision. They helped the individual to see, and they also were the ancient substitute for what we would call anesthesia. For the ancients had, definitely, anesthetic drugs or materials to ease pain. But because there was no contact with the complicated life of a competitive civilization, the individual, if he did have a vision or a dream, should seldom, if ever, have a nightmare, because there was nothing to worry him, nothing to frighten him. Everything was right. Now, that didn't mean that all the things that were happening around him were pleasant, but they were necessary. They were all accepted without resentment, without pressure. The Indian life way would not permit hatred. Therefore, the dreams would not come through with hate symbolism. The individual who had become part of the tribal life found that it was quite possible for him to become slightly entranced and receive a vision or a message that was of great value to his people. But it never caused him to want to do it again soon, or maybe never again. But it was a fact that if he himself had no guile in him, the setting up of habits, like narcotic habits, which take hold of the individual who has never taken hold of himself. The moment the person closes his door to his own weakness and builds strength, he escapes from all of these complications. But as long as he lives in a world of the gratification of his appetites, he will suffer, and all forms of vision, psychic phenomena, narcotics, and everything of this kind will turn on him with viciousness. It's because he himself is not basically clean. Clean of tensions and stresses. Clean of all the things that cause great trouble to the average person. It's interesting also to note that in the Southwest region, there's several very famous old medicine priests. And a great many of the Anglo, that is the non-Indian, non-Mexicans, living in the area, would like to use those fellows for their doctors. They didn't have too much faith in the local medic, and they would have been delighted. But the Indians won't take them because of the complications involved with the American Medical Association. But occasionally someone sneaks through anyway, but it's very rare. But those who have had such experiences have been very much amazed at the constructive results. As the Smithsonian and the American Bureau of Ethnology reports also includes some discussion of the snake dance phenomena of the Southwest. This phenomena has been variously interpreted. One group, of course, that doesn't believe in anything particularly, says that they are harmless snakes. The other group says in some way this poison has been taken out of them, and a third group just doesn't know anything about it anyway. But in these ceremonies, those who attend, non-Indians, are warned to keep away far enough so that there is no danger of becoming involved with these snakes, because they're not pleasant people sometimes. And on one occasion, it is known, someone stepped too close, and as the Indian came by with the snake held between his teeth, the snake bit the white man. Well, there was a moment of very great consternation. The dance was temporarily suspended, and the Indian came forward and said to this man, "If you will give us your word of honor that you will never tell what we do, we'll fix it so you're all right." So he agreed, and they took him down into the kiva and performed the snake ritual for him. He would never tell what happened, but in an hour or two came out perfectly well. They knew how to do it. Something that you don't see that is quite as fantastic as that, of course, I saw one of the Gallup festivals years ago while it was still functioning in full force, and that's the feather dance. In the feather dance, and a group of Indians form a circle and place a fairly large woven basket in the center of the circle, and in this they stand a highly decorated eagle's feather that has been enlarged and has little flangs and tips and tassels hung on it in this basket. They then sit in a circle around it and start chanting. And after a certain length of time, no one is within 10 or 15 feet of the basket, the feather begins to agitate. And in a few minutes, it rises 6 or 8 inches out of the basket and remains in the air for several minutes and then slowly settles back. I think one of the reasons perhaps why they've discontinued these ceremonies is because they annoy people. No one wants to believe these things these days. They want to believe that it's all one great mistake, and that it's due to the fact that these poor benighted souls are not wise enough or good enough to realize that materialism is the answer to everything. In any event, however, walking with the Indians, you find a great many of these interesting and remarkable circumstances arising. I was attended a graduation service at the American Indian School in New Mexico in the middle 40s. This was a graduation class for young Indians who had finished what would be equivalent to us as high school. In other words, they were speaking English. They had taken their examination with the 3 R's and all this type of thing. And were very nice boys and girls. They were typical of a graduation exercise. They all lined up all together on a stage, and the teachers were all there. But most of all, the relatives were all there. And that's what really made the situation tremendous. Out from the reservation came all these mysterious-looking people, wrapped in blankets and hoods, wearing many types of jewelry, which were very beautiful jewelries, but very stoical, with their long braided hair and all their native regalia. And the special section in front had been set aside for the happy and exalted relatives who were all there to see their children or their neighbor's children graduate from school. And it was a very impressive service. The diplomas were given out with great gusto and The parents were beaming from ear to ear. They didn't clap because that was something they hadn't learned to do yet. But they were very pleased about the whole thing. And finally, at the end, the class valedictorian got up and made the speech. And the speech was, "The Wonders of Living in America." And it built up to a very great note in which these Indian children bestowed upon America in general all of the virtues of their own tribe. They were so fond of the wonderful friendliness, the wonderful kindness, the wonderful peace, and all this type of thing. The parents were all nodding enthusiastically in Navajo. But the audience at the back, that made up of the Anglos, looked a little sheepish. But this is the way it is and was there. These people have a very wonderful and very sincere situation involving them at all times in everything that they do. We know several Indians who have gone quite far in their own tribal life, and most of them were very sad because there was no one to carry on. This was perhaps especially true here in the California Indian group. It was then here in outside of Riverside that I saw the Indians perform the fire walking ceremony, which was forbidden. The Indian school at that time, that was many years ago, the school at that time had its own police composed of Indians, and these policemen were supposed to prevent any of these ceremonies from being performed. But the policemen joined in the conspiracy, and before it was over, they too were walking across the bed of coals. But down the back of Riverside, in a ranch of a kindly Anglo, the old ceremonies were carried on for years. Everywhere you find the Indian, you find something of a mystical nature. But you try to understand him and what he stands for, you realize that the great secret of what he has is that he has not yet been spoiled. Many efforts have been made to do it. Everyone has tried desperately to get the Indian out of his own life way. But he has sort of clung to it. And even if the surface has been mutilated in one way or another, the depths have remained comparatively calm. He simply has a concept of life that enables him to be a natural mystic. He can, without any particular effort, do that which most psychics spend years trying to cultivate: the ability to pierce through into an inner communion with self. This communion is based largely upon natural law. For if you go inside of the individual deep enough, you're going to find reality. The inside of the person may not support his outside in all cases, because his outside is apt to be very seriously damaged or contaminated by his worldly situations. But in the inner part of his own life, he lives a very simple, honorable, clean life. And he has a secret tradition about how these things should be done. A few years ago, after the revolution in China, the communist revolution, a group of Tibetans came to this country and went down to New Mexico to see what Indians looked like. When they got there, they thought they were looking in a mirror, because these Indians looked exactly like themselves. The same turquoise jewelry, the same clothes, the same hair, the same facial features, and they might just as well have been looking at each other, which had quite a factor in assuming, or helping to assume, that there certainly was an Asiatic contact there, and probably had, at a very ancient time, a bit of migration from the mainland. The migrations are referred to in ancient literature in Tibet and China, particularly China, but the proofs have never been adequate. Also, the missionaries coming in down in there having their little difficulties, but for the most part, the missionaries in close to the Indian tribes have been pretty fairly fair people. One told me, a missionary who had spent 20 years there, had a little church on one of the pueblos. And he said, you see, they come to worship in the little church every Sunday morning, and then they go out back and perform all their own rituals. It never is interfered with anything. It's like the Chinese. If one religion is good, two is better. The more religions you have, the better chance you have of getting there. So they're very nice. Well, I said to this old man, he's an old priest, I said, what do you do when they do these rituals? Do you join? Well, he said, I don't say I join, but something tells me that I got to get someplace on the other side of the reservation and take care of a little private business. He's never interfered with them. And actually, as he told me seriously, he says, there's some points so close to our own, we wouldn't know where to start interfering. The native religions of these people are, for the most part, very good basic religions, very, very, very fine examples of integrities. Actually, the universe, therefore, consists of these three worlds. And in man, these three worlds are the three parts of himself: body, mind, soul. These are all aligned to their own realms. Each of these belongs to itself. The body is part of a great plan. The body is part of the world in which it exists. It lives in the world, it lives in by keeping the laws of the world. And it continues for its appointed time. Within the body is the mind. And it is the mind that guides the body and makes possible that the body shall become improved. The mind helps to protect the body. It guards it against evils that might otherwise destroy it. And the instruments of the mind are the sensory perceptions, by means of which man is warned of danger or given various ways of improving his life. The other part, the spiritual part, is very secret, very mysterious. It is not symbolized too much, but the great leader of this particular phase of existence is the Manado. The Manado is the great one, the eternal one. The Manado is the one who has his throne upon the North Pole, usually, or somewhere in its equivalent, on the top of one of the mountains of the reservations, apparently. But the Manado is the father of all that lives. And the father of all that lives has two messengers, the phoenix and the serpent. The phoenix bird carries the messages of the Manado to the mind of man and to nature. The serpent is the great earth principle which bears witness and sends up its messages to the mind. Therefore, the outer life is protected by the serpent. The higher life is protected by the phoenix, or the sacred bird. This bird, of course, is definitely the same thing as the phoenix of our own philosophies. And incidentally, originally, the eagle on the Great Seal of the United States was a phoenix bird. Therefore, the bird of divinity, the bird of transformation, the bird of regeneration, the bird of immortality, was not only part of the belief of the Indians, but in some way, maybe through Ben Franklin, who had a mind for those things, brought into the seal of the United States. Therefore, the seal stands as a phoenix symbol of regeneration, restoration, renovation, and transformation, to rise from the darkness of ignorance to the light of reality. The Indians also had sacred places all around through their various reservations and resources. Sometimes in the old days, the Plains Indians just wandered from one place to another. But they also had their laws and their ways and their wisdoms. And everything depended upon the constant vigilance of the individual. I've talked to some Indians who are now part of our way of life. And they point out very carefully, it's very certain, they said, there's something very necessary. The fact that this is a great country with a tremendous complication of life and a tremendous opportunity to grow and to serve and to help, that there has to be some form of discipline. The discipline to keep the values, keep the integrities. With the loss of the discipline, the tribe in the desert or in the wilderness would soon disappear. For lack of discipline, every empire the world has ever built has failed, because the individual gradually became self-seeking, gradually became determined to use his world to attain his own private purposes. The Indian is protected against this because his world was not oriented so that private purposes could mean much. But in the large civilization, there has to be a transformation. We have to learn what the Indian learned when he fed the old and the young first. We have to learn of a great responsibility, and Confucius gave us a great, great key to this, that a surviving civilization has to have its integrities. Now, how do we get these integrities? Can we pass laws for them? We can, but the laws will be broken in a moment. If we are out to find leaders, can the leader lead the rest? Very unlikely. The great tragedy of leadership is always the same. Helping people, as Shaw pointed out, is the world's most dangerous occupation. So what happens? The discipline has to come from within. Now, to come from within, it must come as a mystical experience or as Oranda. Our public school system would be a perfect place for a lot of Oranda, because it could give us the realization of the tremendous amount of reality that has gone into the creation of civilization. The heroes who have never been sung, the martyrs who have died that the future could be better, the spreading of ideals and integrities. Every one of these integrities, as is shown in some of the Indian drawings, is attended by a stumble. The individual cannot go directly from here to eternity without delays, without interferences, without mistakes, without shortcomings of his own. But the general direction of the road must be straight. And that straight road must lead not to some mysterious building somewhere. It must lead to the sky. It must lead to the lodge of the great ones, which is heaven itself. Everything depends on keeping the rules. Everything depends upon disciplining the self, keeping away from the entanglements which destroy the integrities of character. And as the American Indian came into the ways of the non-Indians in this country, we began to see that many of his values are slowly fading. Against this, however, there is a rising spirit among the Indians to make their contribution to the world that has not been very thoughtful of them. And there is today a great feeling among many Indian groups and individuals that they have a tremendous contribution to make to the future of our civilization. That the time has come when the simple, homely values must come back, must be recognized as the supreme values of life. That instead of continuing to build one mistake upon another, we must finally find the straight road that leads in. Now, this road is in everyone. There's no possibility of our not having this path in ourselves. This is the great path of the Rainbow Goddess. This is the marvelous reality that encloses all parts of the great diagram of life. But we have to be capable of internal expression of this. We must learn to remove the whole mass of false attitudes which have become natural to us. We have become not necessarily the victims of our bad habits alone. We have become victims of the entire lack of true insight. We have forgotten that heaven leads and earth must follow, which was the great secret of Taoism. We have forgotten that the power of eternal value must become the leader of life. That somewhere there are laws that are immutable. These are in the great sky lodge of the eternal spirits. These laws must be kept. They cannot be forced upon us by the gods, because the laws are meaningless to us unless we voluntarily accept them. We must make the decisions, not heaven. But if we are wise, we will make the decisions along the straight road that leads back to the stars from which we came. If we can do this, then we can follow the Indian light way. We can follow the idea that they would give us now out of their gradual restoration and reformation. They have gone through the great mistakes that we forced upon them. They have gone through the great errors of personal ambition and all this type of thing. But now they are beginning to realize that the whole answer lies in the purification of their own tradition, that they must find their own life way again. And then if they can help us in any way, it is to help us to find our life way, not necessarily identical with theirs, but a life way that is identical with our own necessity, identical with the mysterious and wonderful constitution which we have been given. We have a destiny, as every creature has a destiny. And if we will find the destiny, we can survive and grow. But the only way to find it is to go in. Go along the old path that leads in to the quietude of a self, which we have freed for this purpose. The mind can give us the quietude, the understanding, and the insight that we can enter into a state of knowing. And in the peace of a peaceful mind guarding our actions and our thoughts, we can then understand the true secret of the constant presence of the gods. The Indian knows that these spirits are everywhere. We kind of think they are. We still pray to them as though they were everywhere. But they know they are everywhere. And the truth is no further from us than it is on the side of the mountain with four prayer plumes and the pipe of peace. That sitting quietly in meditation, we will discover that the eternal is with us, within us, and around us at all times. But we cannot find that which is superior to ourselves while we are satisfied to remain inferior. If we are not in desire of improvement, then we can't get better. But if we desire, we don't have to search. No complicated code or creed is necessary. It is to simply allow the beauty of life, the beauty of eternal truth, and the beauty of everlasting integrity to be what it is, what it has always been, and what we have to search for by giving up the mistakes of our daily conduct. Well, that's all for this morning.